Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Friday, September 29th, 2023. I'm your reader, Catherine Moyers. The headline from today's paper is GOP Lays Out Impeachment Case by Farnoosh Amiri, Lisa Mascaro, and Eric Tucker of the Associated Press. Dateline Washington. House Republicans launched a formal impeachment hearing Thursday against President Joe Biden, promising to provide accountability as they probe the family finances and lucrative business dealings of his son Hunter and make their case to the public, colleagues, and a skeptical Senate. The chairman of the Oversight, Judiciary, and Ways and Means Committees used the opening hearing to review the constitutional and legal questions involved with impeachment. They are trying to show what they claim are links to Biden's son Hunter's overseas businesses, though key witnesses said they do not yet see hard evidence of impeachable offenses. Representative James Comer, Republican of Kentucky, the oversight chairman, said lawmakers have a mountain of evidence that will show that the elder Biden abused his public office for his family's financial gain. Comer announced he will issue subpoenas for additional banking records from Hunter Biden and the president's brother, James Biden. He said the panel will continue to follow the money and the evidence to provide accountability. It's a high-stakes opening act for Republicans taking place just before a potential federal government shutdown, as they begin a process that can lead to the ultimate penalty for a president, dismissal from office for what the Constitution describes as high crimes and misdemeanors. The White House pushed back with statements throughout the hearing saying nothing can distract from the Republicans' inability to govern as the shutdown loomed. Spokesperson Sharon Yang called the hearing a baseless stunt and said President Biden will always stay focused on the priorities of the American people, not these political games. The more than six-hour hearing came as House Republicans faced scattered resistance to an impeachment inquiry from their own ranks. Senate Republicans worry about political ramifications and say Biden's conviction and removal from office is unlikely. As the hearing began, Democrats displayed a screen showing the days, hours, and minutes left until the government shuts down as Congress struggles to fund the government before Saturday's deadline. We are 62 hours away from shutting down the government of the United States of America, and Republicans are launching an impeachment drive based on a long debunked and discredited line, Representative Jamie Raskin, the top Democrat on the oversight panel, said as the day began. Raskin questioned the legitimacy of the hearing since the House did not vote to formally launch the impeachment inquiry. He said Republicans are rehashing five-year-old allegations raised by Donald Trump, Biden's chief rival, in 2024 during the former president's 2019 impeachment over Ukraine. They don't have a shred of evidence against President Biden for an impeachable offense, he said. The hearing Thursday did not feature witnesses with information about the Bidens or Hunter Biden's business. Instead, the panel heard from outside experts in tax law, criminal investigations, and constitutional legal theory. Jonathan Turley, a George Washington University law professor and expert in impeachment issues, said he believed the House passed the threshold for an inquiry, but that the evidence was not enough for charges. I do not believe that the current evidence would support articles of impeachment, said Turley, a top Republican called witness. Democrats, who decry the investigation as a political ploy, aimed at hurting Biden and helping Trump as he runs again for president, brought in Michael Gerhardt, a law professor who also appeared as an expert in previous impeachment proceedings. In detailing the reasons Republicans say they have to impeach Biden, Gerhardt concluded, if that's what exists as a basis for this inquiry, it is not sufficient. I say that with all respect. Still, questions remain as Republicans dig into the Biden family finances and the overseas business dealings of Hunter Biden, who has acknowledged being a drug user during much of the time under scrutiny. The president's brother, James, was also involved in some work with Hunter. Republicans have been investigating Hunter Biden for years since his father was vice president. While there have been questions about the ethics around the family's international business, none of the evidence so far has proven that the president, in his current or previous office, abused his role, accepted bribes, or both. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy announced the impeachment inquiry this month, egged on by Trump and with mounting pressure from his right flank to take action against Biden or risk being ousted from his leadership job. Trump is the only president to be twice impeached, first over accusations he pressured Ukraine to dig up dirt on Biden, and later over accusations that he incited the January 6, 2021 insurrection at the Capitol. He was acquitted in both cases by the Senate. The hearing Thursday was expected to be the first of many as House Republicans explore whether they will pursue articles of impeachment against the president. It's unclear if McCarthy has support from his slim Republican majority to impeach Biden. If Biden was impeached, the charges would be sent to the Senate for a trial. The next story from the front page is Grassley, Threats to Shut Down Government Over Policy, Idiotic, by Caleb McCullough, Dateline Des Moines. With only a few days left for Congress to avert a government shutdown, Iowa U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley said it is idiotic to hold up government funding over certain policy goals and argued a shutdown would hurt American taxpayers. Grassley, a Republican, joined Senate Democrats and most Republicans Tuesday night to advance a stopgap funding bill to keep the government open until mid-November. The bill, which includes around $6 billion in funding for Ukraine, is not likely to gain enough support in the Republican-controlled House to pass. Some far-right Republicans have pushed for any government funding package to include key conservative policy items like tighter border security and cuts to Ukraine aid. With a slim Republican House majority, those representatives can tank any budget measures that don't have support from Democrats. Without a short-term funding bill agreed to by both chambers, the U.S. federal government will shut down on Sunday. Certain essential workers would still report for work but will not get paid until the shutdown ends. Non-essential workers would be furloughed without pay. While Grassley said he also wants more border security, he told reporters on Wednesday holding up government funding to pursue policy goals is idiotic and does not often end in success. People say they want to accomplish ABC or XYZ, and so you shut down the government, he said. And then, a few days later, you get so much heat, you open up the government again, and you didn't accomplish ABC or XYZ. Grassley said a shutdown would be costly and prevent Congress from carrying out important duties that are funded by taxpayers. Just keeping the government open is so, so very important, he said. It costs money to shut down government. It costs money to open up government. Grassley said he supports passing legislation that would set up automatic short-term funding bills called continuing resolutions so the government could not be shut down over budget impasses. He said that would take the wind out of the sails of Republican representatives that are holding up budget votes over border security measures. Iowa Democrats criticized Republicans on Tuesday for failing to pass a budget and said Iowa's representatives should work with Democrats to avert a shutdown. In a press call, Iowa Democratic Party Chair Rita Hart said a shutdown would affect Iowa families, small business owners, and farmers. Republicans are busy playing political games and trying to ram through massive cuts that have no shot of making it through the Senate, Hart said. Iowa U.S. Representative Zach Nunn, a Republican who represents Iowa's 3rd District, introduced a pair of bills on Wednesday that he said would hold politicians accountable during a government shutdown. Nunn has been critical of the budgeting process and called for his fellow Republicans to pass a budget on time. One proposed bill, called the No Work, No Pay Act, would effectively suspend pay for members of Congress during a shutdown by fining them the equivalent of a day's pay each day the government is closed. Members of Congress, who are paid $175,000 a year, are generally still paid during a government shutdown. And the 27th Amendment to the Constitution prevents changes in compensation from taking effect until the following election. Another bill, the People Before Politics Act, would ban members of Congress from fundraising for their re-election campaign during a shutdown, according to a news release from Nunn's office. "Our government is supposed to be of the people, by the people, and for the people," Nunn said in a written statement. "Well, the people have had enough of greedy, self-aggrandizing clowns putting their own personal profit ahead of the American people. D.C. politicians need to play by the same rules as the rest of the American people." Turning to page 2, at the top of the page, "Michael Gambon, actor who played Dumbledore, dies at 82. By Sylvia Hugh. Dateline, London. Michael Gambon, the Irish-born actor knighted for his storied career on the stage and screen, and who went on to gain admiration from a generation of moviegoers with his portrayal of Hogwarts headmaster Albus Dumbledore in the 6 of the 8 Harry Potter films, has died. He was 82. The actor died on Wednesday following a bout of pneumonia, his publicist Claire Dobbs said on Thursday. "We are devastated to announce the loss of Sir Michael Gambon. Beloved husband and father, Michael died peacefully in hospital with his wife Anne and son Fergus at his bedside," his family said in a statement. While the Potter role raised Gambon's international profile and found him a huge audience, he was long recognized as one of Britain's leading actors. His work spanned TV, theater, and radio, and he starred in dozens of films from Gosford Park and The King's Speech to the animated family movie Paddington. He recently appeared in the Judy Garland biopic Judy, released in 2019. Gambon was knighted for his contribution to the entertainment industry in 1998. The role of the much-loved Professor Dumbledore was initially played by another Irish-born actor, Richard Harris. When Harris died in 2002, after two of the films in the franchise had been made, Gambon took over and played the part from Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban through to Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2. He once acknowledged not having read any of J.K. Rowling's best-selling books, arguing that it was safer to follow the script rather than be too influenced by the books. That didn't prevent him from embodying the spirit of the powerful wizard who fought against evil to protect his students. Fiona Shaw, who played Petunia Dursley in the Harry Potter series, recalled Gambon telling her how central acting was to his life. "He did once say to me in a car, 'I know I go on a lot of about this and that, but actually, in the end, there is only acting,'" Shaw told the BBC on Thursday. "I think he was always pretending that he didn't take it seriously, but he took it profoundly seriously." Born in Dublin on October 19, 1940, Gambon was raised in London and originally trained as an engineer, following in the footsteps of his father. He made his theater debut in a production of Othello in Dublin. In 1963, he got his first big break with a minor role in Hamlet, the National Theatre Company's opening production under the directorship of the legendary Laurence Olivier. Gambon soon became a distinguished stage actor and received critical acclaim for his leading performance in Life of Galileo, directed by John Dexter. He was frequently nominated for awards and won the Laurence Olivier Award 3 times and the Critics' Circle Theatre Awards twice. A multi-talented actor, Gambon was also the recipient of 4 coveted British Academy of Film and Television Arts Awards for his television work. He became a household name in Britain after his lead role in the 1986 BBC TV series, The Singing Detective, written by Dennis Potter and considered a classic of British television drama. Gambon won the BAFTA for Best Actor for the role. Gambon also won Emmy nominations for more recent television work as Mr. Woodhouse in a 2010 adaptation of Jane Austen's Emma, and as former U.S. President Lyndon B. Johnson in 2002's Path to War. Gambon was versatile as an actor, but once told the BBC he preferred to play villainous characters. He played gangster Eddie Temple in the British crime thriller Layer Cake. A review of the film by the New York Times referred to Gambon as reliably excellent, and a satanic crime boss in Peter Greenaway's the cook, the thief, his wife, and her lover. Next is Disney World Government Will Give Employees Stipend After Backlash by Mike Schneider, Dateline, Orlando, Florida. Facing a backlash, Walt Disney World's governing district will pay a stipend to employees whose free passes and discounts to the theme park resort were eliminated under a policy made by a new district administrator and board members who are allies of Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. The stipend will be $3,000 a year, which is around the equivalent value of the theme park passes, Glenn Gilzine, District Administrator of the Central Florida Tourism Oversight District, told board members during a meeting Wednesday evening. The board then unanimously approved the stipend. Board members said they had taken to heart the criticism of employees who said the free passes gave them lasting memories with their families and allowed relatives to see the fruits of their work. Without the free passes, the parks would be unaffordable, many employees said. We heard you and have worked to respond accordingly, said board member Ron Perry. Employees had enjoyed the perk for decades when Disney controlled the governing district. The district was taken over by DeSantis and the Florida legislature earlier this year in retaliation to Disney's opposition last year to a state law critics have called Don't Say Gay, which banned classroom lessons on sexual orientation and gender identity in early grades. Formerly known as the Reedy Creek Improvement District, the now renamed Central Florida Tourism Oversight District provides municipal services like mosquito control, drainage, and wastewater treatment. In justifying their elimination, board members claimed that $2.5 million in theme park season passes, as well as discounts on hotels, merchandise, food, and beverages that their Disney-supporting predecessors provided governing district employees amounted to an unethical benefits and perks. The arrangement was self-serving to the company because it funneled money back to Disney, with the district footing the bill, according to board members. Now turning to page 3, we have this story titled, Utility Officials Testify at Hearing. Administrators don't have answers on what caused the deadly blaze. By Rebecca Boone. Maui Wildfire. Lawmakers probing the cause of last month's deadly Maui wildfire did not get many answers during Thursday's congressional hearing on the role of the electrical grid played in the disaster. Still, the president of Hawaiian Electric, Maui's sole electricity provider, promised to gather and provide more details about what happened August 8th. Including when the power stopped flowing through downed power lines in Lahaina, and when the decision was made to trigger a procedure designed to make sure that broken lines were not re-energized. Sheila Kimura also said the utility doesn't have the right or responsibility to clear dry brush or other vegetation on private property, even if it is in the right-of-way directly underneath power lines, unless the plants or trees are tall enough to potentially contact the lines. The fire in the historic district of Lahaina killed at least 97 people and destroyed more than 2,000 buildings, mostly homes. It erupted at 6:30 a.m. when strong winds appeared to cause a Hawaiian Electric power line to fall, igniting dry brush and grass near a large subdivision. Aerial and satellite imagery reviewed by the Associated Press show the gully where the fire reignited later that afternoon has long been choked with plants and trash, which a severe summer drought turned into tinder-dry fuel for fires. Photos taken after the blaze show charred foliage in the utility's right-of-way, still more than 10 feet high. During the U.S. House Energy and Commerce Subcommittee hearing, lawmakers questioned Kimura and other utility officials about how the deadliest U.S. wildfire in more than a century began. Asked to address whether the electrical grid in Lahaina was safe and properly maintained, Kimura told the committee that 2,000 of the company's wooden power poles had not been tested or treated for possible termites, rot, or other problems since 2013. The other 29,000 poles on the island were assessed under Hawaiian Electric's test and treat program, she said, but the remaining 2,000 were not yet done. Kimura said she didn't know where those untested poles were located or if they were in the area of the Lahaina fire. But at least one pole near where the fire started was tested and treated in 2022, she said. The next story is American soldier who crossed into North Korea arrives back in the U.S. Video appears to show by Eric Gay, Matthew Lee, and Lolita C. Baldor. Dateline San Antonio. The American soldier who sprinted into North Korea across the heavily fortified border between the Koreas more than 2 months ago arrived back in the U.S. early Thursday, video appeared to show. North Korea abruptly announced Wednesday that it would expel Private Travis King. His return was organized with the help of ally Sweden and rival China, according to the White House. While officials have said King, 23, is in good health and the immediate focus will be on caring for him and reintegrating him into U.S. society, his troubles are likely far from over. King, who had served in South Korea, ran into the North while on a civilian tour of a border village on July 18th, becoming the first American confirmed to be detained in the isolated country in nearly 5 years. At the time, he was supposed to be heading to Fort Bliss, Texas, following his release from prison in South Korea on an assault conviction. He was declared AWOL from the Army. In many cases, someone who is AWOL for more than a month can automatically be considered a deserter. Punishment for going AWOL or desertion can vary, and it depends in part on whether the service member voluntarily returned or was apprehended. King's handover by the North Koreans makes that more complicated. Video aired Thursday by a Texas news station appeared to show King walking off a plane in San Antonio. Dressed in a dark top and pants, he could be seen speaking briefly with people waiting on the tarmac. He shook hands with one before being led into a building. Emails seeking comment were sent to Lackland Air Force Base in Texas, the Air Force, and the Army. Officials earlier said he would be taken to Brooke Army Medical Center at Fort Sam Houston. He is expected to undergo psychological assessments and debriefings, and he also will get a chance to meet with family. He will be in military custody throughout the process since his legal situation is complicated. Many questions remain about King's case, including why he fled in the first place and why the North, which has tense relations with Washington over Pyongyang's nuclear program, support for Russia's war in Ukraine, and other issues, agreed to turn him over. The White House has not addressed North Korean state media reports that King fled because of his dismay about racial discrimination and inequality in the military and U.S. society. The North's official Korean Central News Agency reported that King made such complaints, but verifying that is impossible. On Wednesday, Swedish officials took King to the Chinese border, where he was met by U.S. Ambassador to China, Nicholas Burns, the Swedish ambassador to China, and at least one U.S. Defense Department official. He was then flown to a U.S. military base in South Korea before heading to the U.S. His detention was relatively short by North Korean standards. Recent American detainees have been held for over a year, 17 months in the case of Otto Warmbier, a college student who was arrested during a group tour. Warmbier was in a coma when he was deported and later died. North Korea has often been accused of using American detainees as bargaining chips, and there had also been speculation that the North would try to maximize the propaganda value of a U.S. soldier. But analysts say King's legal troubles could have limited his propaganda value, and Biden administration officials insisted they provided no concessions to North Korea to secure his release. Next is, economy grew at 2.1% annual pace. This is an Associated Press article, Dateline Washington. The U.S. economy grew at a 2.1% annual pace from April through June, extending its sturdy performance in the face of higher interest rates, the government said Thursday, leaving its previous estimate unchanged. The second quarter expansion of the nation's gross domestic product, its total output of goods and services, marked a modest deceleration from the economy's 2.2% annual growth from January through March. Consumer spending, business investment, and state and local government outlays drove the second quarter economic expansion. The economy and job market have shown surprising resilience, even as the Federal Reserve repeatedly raised interest rates to combat inflation, which last year hit a four-decade high. The Federal Bank raised its benchmark rate 11 times since March 2022. So far, though, inflation has eased without causing much economic pain, raising hopes that the central bank can pull off a so-called soft landing, following and slowing the economy enough to conquer high inflation without causing a painful recession. And the briefly column, Menendez. New Jersey Senator Robert Menendez remained defiant Thursday in the face of federal bribery charges, telling a closed-door room full of his Senate Democratic colleagues that he has no plans to resign. Trump. Former President Donald Trump will not seek to get his Georgia election interference case transferred to federal court, his attorney said in a filing Thursday, 3 weeks after a judge rejected a similar attempt to move the trial by the former president's White House chief of staff, Mark Meadows. Artificial intelligence. The National Security Agency is starting an artificial intelligence security center as AI capabilities are increasingly acquired, developed, and integrated into U.S. defense and intelligence systems, the agency's outgoing director announced Thursday. Ukraine war. NATO Secretary General met with Ukraine's president to discuss the war and needs of troops Thursday, the day after Russia accused Ukraine's Western allies of helping plan and conduct last week's missile strike on the Black Sea Fleet's headquarters in the Crimean Peninsula. Fast food. California's fast food workers will be paid at least $20 per hour next year under a new law signed Thursday by Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom. And traffic deaths. Traffic fatalities dropped 3.3% to an estimated 19,515 in the first half of the year, compared with the prior year period, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration reported Thursday. You are listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Friday, September 29, 2023, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Next, we'll turn to today's obituaries. There were no obituaries, so we will turn to the sports page. And NFL Thursday Night Football, Detroit 34 and Green Bay 20. Montgomery and Lions run over the Packers. Dateline Green Bay, Wisconsin. David Montgomery rushed for 121 yards and 3 touchdowns, and the Detroit Lions asserted themselves as the team to beat in the NFC North, dominating the first half and beating the Green Bay Packers 34-20 on Thursday night. Montgomery carried the ball 32 times after he sat out the Lions' victory over Atlanta last Sunday with a thigh bruise. He became the first Lion to rush for 3 touchdowns at Green Bay and the first Detroit player to top 100 yards rushing with 3 TDs since James Stewart in 2000. The Lions, 3-1, beat the Packers, 2-2, for a fourth straight time, a streak that also includes the final game of last season when Detroit denied Green Bay a playoff spot in Aaron Rodgers' last game with the Packers. Rodgers' replacement, Jordan Love, threw for a touchdown and ran for another as he tried to rally the Packers in the second half. He finished 23 of 36 for 246 yards and was picked off twice by Jerry Jacobs. Detroit led 27-3 at halftime and had outgained Green Bay 284 yards to 21 as the half ended with boos from the crowd. It was the Lions' highest scoring first half against the Packers in the series' 188-game history. The Packers had staged an improbable rally 5 days earlier, trailing New Orleans 17-0 before scoring 18 points in the final 11 minutes for a one-point victory. Green Bay faced a halftime deficit of at least 17 points in back-to-back weeks for the first time in franchise history, and this time it was too much to overcome. Love got the Packers within 10 points. His 1-yard touchdown pass to Christian Watson capped a season-long 86-yard drive to open the second half. Jaden Reed ended the third quarter with a 44-yard catch that set up Love's 9-yard touchdown run with 14 minutes and 52 seconds left in the game to make it 27-17. Detroit responded with a 14-play, 75-yard drive, capped by Montgomery's 1-yard touchdown run on a third and goal that took nearly 9 minutes off the clock and put the game away. The Lions were prepared to settle for a 30-yard field goal that would have kept it as a 2-score game, but as they got a first down with Green Bay's Quay Walker, received an unsportsmanlike conduct penalty for running forward and leaping across the line in an attempt to block the kick. Considering the way the game started, it was surprising it was still competitive in the fourth quarter. Rudy Ford intercepted Jared Goff on the third play from scrimmage to set up a field goal. Detroit then scored 24 points on its next 4 drives to delight the sizable contingent of Lion fans who decorated the Lambeau Field stands in Honolulu blue. Goff's 24-yard touchdown pass to a wide-open Amon-Ra St. Brown put the Lions ahead for good. Montgomery scored on runs of 3 and 2 yards, while Riley Patterson kicked field goals of 33 and 37 yards. The second quarter was nearly halfway over, and the Lions already led 24-3 when the Packers finally got their initial first down thanks to a Detroit penalty. The Packers didn't get a first down on their own merits until 7 seconds remained before halftime. Goff threw for 210 yards and a touchdown. Turning to Major League Baseball, this story is titled Analysis. It looks like it'll take all 162 games to decide Major League Baseball's postseason races, by David Brandt, Dateline Phoenix. It might take all 162 games to decide the playoff races in both the National League and American League. The epicenter of the wild card chase this weekend is in Arizona at Chase Field. Thanks to some fortuitous interleague scheduling, the AL's Houston Astros face the NL's Arizona Diamondbacks in a 3-game set crucial to races in both leagues. Defending champion Houston is fighting for a berth after a September swoon. The Diamondbacks, who have played better lately after their own second-half slide, are trying to make the postseason for the first time since 2017. "We know it's right in front of us," Arizona manager Torey Luvullo said after his team beat the White Sox on Wednesday. "We control our own destiny in this particular situation." Here's a look at some of the other series this weekend that will decide the postseason field. Rangers at Mariners. This is a big 4-game set that actually began Thursday night with both teams fighting for position in the AL West and the AL wildcard race. The Rangers have played well over the past 1.5 weeks, opening a 2.5-game division lead. Texas probably is fine with a win or two in the series, while Seattle might need to sweep. Rays at Blue Jays. The Rays have already secured their berth, though they could still catch the Orioles for the AL East title. The Blue Jays are fighting for an AL wildcard spot, and winning at least 2 of 3 against Tampa Bay would go a long way toward securing that goal. Cubs at Brewers. The Cubs just finished a tough series against Atlanta and have lost 9 times in September in games in which they led. The NL Central leading Brewers are locked into their playoff spot. Marlins at Pirates. The Marlins have been playing roughly 500 ball for the better part of a month. They'll need a big weekend against the Pirates, possibly a sweep, to have a chance at making the postseason. Reds at Cardinals. The surprising Reds have been sliding some in recent weeks. They'll likely need a sweep over the Cardinals to have much of a shot at sneaking into the postseason. Awards races. The most intrigue still surrounds the National League Cy Young Award race, which has a handful of solid candidates in San Diego's Blake Snell, Chicago's Justin Steele, Arizona's Zach Galen, and Atlanta's Spencer Strider. Strider got a shot in his final start to become the major's only 20-game winner. Steele and Gallen will have one more chance to impress in the middle of that National League wildcard race. Ron Acuna Jr. recently created the 40-homer, 70-stolen base club after the Braves star became the first player to reach both those marks in the same season. With apologies to teammate Matt Olson and Dodgers standout Mookie Betts and Freddie Freeman, he's still the favorite for the National League MVP. Yankee star Gerrit Cole pitched a two-hit shutout against Toronto, clinching the AL era title and strengthening his Cy Young case. Miguel Cabrera hit his 511th homer on Wednesday. The 40-year-old is putting the finishing touches on a stellar career that includes two MVP awards, a triple crown, four batting titles, 12 All-Star appearances, and a 2003 World Series title. There was a 13-year stretch from 2004 to 2006 when he was one of the most feared hitters in baseball. Francona's finale? All signs point to this being Cleveland manager Terry Francona's final season in the dugout. The 64-year-old has been slowed by major health issues in recent years, but if this is it, there's little doubt the personable, popular Francona has left a lasting imprint as manager and one of the game's most beloved figures. He won World Series titles with Boston in 2004 and 2007 before guiding the Guardians over the past 11 years, which have included 9 winning seasons. Eyes on the ball. MLB has enjoyed a big boost in attendance this season, averaging roughly 29,000 fans per game going into the final weekend. That's much better than 26,843 fans per game from 2022 and 18,901 in 2021, which were both affected by the COVID-19 pandemic. No fans were allowed in parks during the 2020 regular season. But that doesn't explain all of this year's jump. The sport is poised to draw its most fans since 2017, when the average was just shy of 30,000. One popular hypothesis is the newly introduced pitch clock has made the sport much more watchable, shaving more than 20 minutes off of games. Now turning to pro golf and the Ryder Cup. The Ryder Cup is finally here. U.S. skipper Zach Johnson says it's time to let the thoroughbreds run. By Doug Ferguson. Dateline, Guidonia, Monticello, Italy. Big winners 2 years ago in Wisconsin, the Americans know a Ryder Cup victory away from home has been out of reach for the past 30 years. Among the challenges is a pro-European crowd ready to cheer and jeer every miss. So it was no surprise Thursday on the eve of the Ryder Cup to hear U.S. Captain Zach Johnson do all he could to curry favor with the host nation in the opening ceremony. He offered endless praise of Italy and immigrants who have added so much to American culture and character. And this week, in a small way, we hope America can give something back to Italy, he said. European captain Luke Donald thought of one thing America could offer. Yeah, a little gold trophy would be nice on Sunday evening, he said. The battle for the 17-inch Ryder Cup in U.S. possession since that 19-9 beating at Whistling Straits in 2021, gets started Friday morning at Marco Simone. It's a golf course built for big excitement at an event that really doesn't need much help. It's not so much the reachable par fives and the short par fours. Victor Hovland charged up the crowd Thursday with his mulligan albatross. After an errant tee shot, he dropped a ball on the tee at the 302-yard fifth and knocked it in with a 3-wood. This is as much about the hills and layout that allow for good views and lots of noise. Playing before a hostile crowd is never easy, and perhaps one reason Team USA has not left European soil with the Ryder Cup since 1993. Johnson believes this year will be different, just like captains of the previous 6 visiting U.S. teams before him. He felt good enough to sit out Jordan Spieth and Justin Thomas from the opening session of foursomes Friday morning, along with Brooks Koepka, a 5-time major champion he said was built for big stages like this. Really at peace with where things are, Johnson said, extremely confident in our 12 guys. Johnson is sending out world number one Scotty Scheffler and his close friend Sam Burns to face Masters champion John Rahm and Tyrell Hatton in the first of 4 matches in the opening session. 4 matches of 4 balls follow in the afternoon, with the same schedule on Saturday, and then 12 singles matches on Sunday to decide the cup. The Americans are defending champions and only need 14 out of the 20 8 points available to retain the Ryder Cup. In other matches, Hovland and Swedish rookie Ludvig Åberg will face the Ryder Cup rookie duo of Max Homa and British Open champion Brian Harman. Colin Morikawa and Ricky Fowler face Sepp Straka and Shane Lowry, and the anchor match feels like a heavyweight material. Patrick Cantlay and Xander Schauffele against Rory McIlroy and Tommy Fleetwood. McIlroy is the most experienced Ryder Cup player and number two in the world. Fleetwood went 4-0 in his partnership with Francesco Molinari in his memorable debut before a home European crowd outside Paris in 2018. It's a really strong American team, and they have a lot of really tough partnerships. We're going up against one of them tomorrow in Xander and Patrick. They've got an incredible record, McIlroy said. I just hope I can live up to Francesco. I'm really trying to do it here. If I can live up to Francesco, I think we'll be okay. The 4 days of build-up to the opening session felt as long as the 2 years since the last Ryder Cup. Teams played 9-hole practice rounds in between team photos, interviews, gala dinners, and motivational moments with their respective team rooms. Once the ball is in the air before an enormous arena around the first tee, the action becomes relentless all the way through to the end. The captains and their assistants have analyzed the statistical data of their players and potential partnerships. They have watched them practice. There comes a point when you've just got to let your thoroughbreds run, Johnson said, and I think we're at that point. But I'm confident in the approach we've had up to this point. The only surprise was sitting Spieth in his fifth Ryder Cup and Thomas for the opening session, though they likely will be playing four balls in the afternoon. It's the first time Spieth has not played in the opening session. Johnson said it was a matter of numbers. Four matches means he had to sit four players. U.S. Open champion Wyndham Clark also is sitting. And it's unlikely most players will go all five matches given the heat and terrain outside Rome. The eight guys I have down on paper are the ones that we feel best put us in the position to get off to a great start, Johnson said. I have the utmost confidence in these eight and the utmost confidence in Jordan and Justin. I know we're talking about a great tandem, but it's a situation where it's not about their form. They're playing great, so it's really just a matter of trying to dissect all five sessions. No one keeps score outside the ropes, but it felt as though Donald went one up in the opening ceremony by speaking beautifully in Italian to welcome the crowd and then including the 12 caddies as making them every bit of the team. But it's decided by keeping the ball in short grass, holding points, and earning points. I have a lot of faith in my team, but at the same time, I certainly don't underestimate the U.S. side. There's some strong players, Donald said. There's a lot of players that played 2 years ago in Whistling Straits. They have some pairings that have astronomical win percentages that have had a lot of success. I'm very happy with the progress of my team, he said. The preparation for the last few days has been fantastic. They've given a lot over the last 3 days. They're very engaged, and they are ready to compete. Turning back to Major League Baseball, Friday's games in the American League. Cleveland at Detroit at 5:40 p.m. Boston at Baltimore at 6:05 p.m. Tampa Bay at Toronto, 6:07 p.m. New York Yankees at Kansas City at 7:10 p.m. Oakland at Los Angeles Angels, 8:38 p.m. and Texas at Seattle, 9:10 p.m. In the National League, Miami at Pittsburgh, 5:35 p.m. Philadelphia at the New York Mets, 6:10 p.m. Washington at Atlanta, 6:20 p.m. Chicago Cubs at Milwaukee, 7:10 p.m. Cincinnati at St. Louis, 7:15 p.m. L.A. Dodgers at San Francisco, 9:15 p.m. And Interleague, San Diego at Chicago White Sox at 6:40 p.m. Minnesota at Colorado at 7:10 p.m. And Houston at Arizona at 8:40 p.m. Next is White Sox delay D-backs playoff bid. Dateline Chicago. The Arizona Diamondbacks delay clinching an NL wildcard berth, losing to the White Sox 3-1 on Thursday as Andrew Vaughn and Yoan Moncada homered for Chicago. Arizona is in a position for the second National League wildcard and its first postseason appearance since 2017. The Diamondbacks entered two games ahead of the Chicago Cubs and Miami, who were tied for third and final spot. Arizona would have clinched Thursday with both a win and a Cubs loss at Atlanta. Like I've been saying, we have to win every baseball game that we play in, and we didn't do that today, so there's some frustration, Diamondback manager Tory Lovullo said. We have to be better. We have to be better in all areas. Each team had three hits, and Arizona went 0-for-5 with runners in scoring position. Tanner Banks, the second of five Chicago pitchers, threw a scoreless fifth. Brian Shaw got three straight outs for his fourth save in five chances. Brewers 3, Cardinals 0. Garrett Mitchell doubled, walked twice, and scored in his first big league game since April, and host Milwaukee beat St. Louis. Corbin Burns, Julio Teheran, and Ethan Small combined on a six-hitter for the NL Central champions. Burns struck out 4 and walked 1 in 4 innings, throwing 39 of his 66 pitches for strikes. Tigers 8-7, Royals 0-3. Miguel Cabrera hit his 511th home run as Detroit won the competition of a suspended game, and Spencer Torkelson hit a three-run homer in a seventh inning to lead the host Tigers over Kansas City for a sweep of both games. Athletics 2, Twins 1. Rookie Ryan Noda hit a tie-breaking homer in the eighth, and visiting Oakland held on against AL Central champion Minnesota. Pirates 3, Phillies 2. Kyle Schwarber went deep, Bryce Harper went off on an umpire and was ejected, and Trey Turner went from second to home on a stolen base in host Philadelphia's loss to Pittsburgh. Orioles 2, Red Sox 0. Anthony Santander homered, D.L. Hall worked out of a sixth inning jam, and host Baltimore clinched the AL East title with a victory over Boston. Blue Jays 6, Yankees 0. Chris Bassett reached 200 innings for the first time. Brandon Belt hit a three-run homer, and host Toronto moved one step closer to a wild-card berth by beating New York. Dalton Varsho and Matt Chapman hit solo home runs for the Blue Jays. Braves 5, Cubs 3. Matt Olson hit his league-leading 54th homer, and host Atlanta beat Chicago to clinch home field advantage throughout the postseason. Rockies 14, Dodgers 5. Brenton Doyle drove in four runs. Elijuras Montero finished a triple shy of hitting for the cycle, and host Colorado defeated Los Angeles. Mariners 3, Rangers 2. J.P. Crawford lined a two-run double with two out in the ninth inning, lifting host Seattle over Texas and stopping the Rangers from clinching a playoff berth for at least one day. That's it for sports, so we turn to the lifestyle page and this article titled, A Dog-Safe Way to Deter Cats, by Kathy M. Rosenthal. Dear Kathy, I have a nine-month-old and a six-year-old Havanese. Stray cats use my ornamental grass and lawn as their litter box, which happened when the first dog was a pup. While it stopped the first time, I guess the cats figured out the puppy wasn't going anywhere, it started again since getting the nine-month-old puppy. My new puppy eats and rolls around in their waste. What plants or strategies will keep stray cats away but are safe for dogs? By Deborah Hicks, New York. Dear Deborah, the humane way to keep cats out of your yard is to install motion detector sprinklers. When you're in the yard with your dogs, simply turn them off. As for plants, you could plant marigolds, lavender, rosemary, rue, curry plants, lemongrass, and pepper plants. Or because cats hate citrus smells, you could put a few grapefruit and orange peels in your flower beds. But strong scents tend to repel both dogs and cats, so I would stick to the motion detector sprinklers. And when your new puppy decides to roll around in the cat poop, call him to you. Say his reward word, for example, bingo, for responding, and give him a treat. Then redirect him with a toy or game. Since you say the cats did this temporarily when your six-year-old dog was a puppy, perhaps they will stop again when they realize the new dog is not leaving either. Dear Kathy, I had the same problem as Carol from Connecticut regarding barking dogs. I spoke to my neighbor, and there was no difference. I went to animal control, and within a week or two, they had spoken to my neighbor about the problem. She may have a lazy animal control department or officer who doesn't want to do their job. And that's from Darren of Woodstock, Connecticut. Dear Darren, I had written to Carol about how animal control worked a little differently in Connecticut from what I am used to seeing, and that maybe that was having some impact on her ability to get help. So I am glad to hear your local animal control responded to your complaint and spoke to the owners. Dogs bark. It's part of who they are and how they alert us to things that are out of place. But if they are constantly barking, then it's animal control officers who should address the issue with owners. Thank you for sharing your experience. Dear Kathy, I read your column about Carol from Connecticut with the barking dogs. Whenever I am in my backyard, my next-door neighbor goes into his backyard with his aggressive dog and trains the dog to attack. This neighbor stands next to our shared fence and repeatedly issues the command, bark. His dog loudly barks, and then this neighbor rewards the dog by saying, good boy, good boy. And then the neighbor loudly issues the command, get her, get her. And when I'm outside in front of my house and this dog is in his backyard, he aggressively barks and growls at me. When I called animal control to report this, I was told, there are just irresponsible dog owners. Call the police. I called the police. I'm told there's nothing we can do until something happens. Call animal control. Isn't it too late after something happens? What do I do? Pamela from East Meadow, New York. Dear Pamela, while it's true there is little animal control can do about the dog until something happens, there is something they can do with the humans before something happens. Animal control is tasked with keeping the community safe, and part of that involves talking to residents about proper pet care and restraint. If neighbors suspect a potentially dangerous dog in the neighborhood, they should all file complaints with animal control, and an animal control officer should investigate and educate the family about what could happen to them should their dog injure or kill someone. Not only would the dog likely be euthanized, but the owner in some states can be convicted of a felony, be fined, and serve jail time. That can have a sobering effect on some people to ensure they have a social dog. And that column is by Kathy M. Rosenthal, and she is an author and pet expert. You can email her at kathy@petpundit.com. Please include your name, city, and state. And you can follow her at Kathy M. Rosenthal. And that does it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Friday, September 29th, 2023. I'm your reader, Catherine Moyers. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thank you for listening.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. A decade ago, there were typically 20 earthquakes a year that were large enough to feel in the central and eastern U.S. But in 2015, there were over 1,000 of them. Why? It's mostly because we're pumping more water into the ground. The boom in U.S. oil and gas production over the last decade has brought many more oil wells, which also produce water. Most is naturally occurring in the formation, and some was injected by operators to allow or improve the recovery of oil and gas. In both cases, the water will likely have picked up salt and other minerals from the rock, making it many times saltier than seawater. Operators may re-inject this water to continue to liberate oil and gas. But more often, there's too much to handle, so it's trucked or piped to disposal wells, where it's pumped down into deep saltwater reservoirs. Adding large volumes of wastewater increases the pressure in these rock formations, which can allow natural faults to slip more easily than they normally would, causing earthquakes. To address these quakes, regulators and the petroleum industry are monitoring disposal wells and shutting down those that could cause damaging seismic activity. And they now think that managing wastewater injection more carefully should help. There's still more work to be done, and university research centers, like the Bureau of Economic Geology, are conducting major studies with the aim of minimizing the risk of earthquakes while maintaining the benefits of domestic energy production. For Earth Date, I'm Scott Tinker.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.